sneaked into the devastation of the command center. It was easy to know where Kerrigan had gone. Mike just followed the path of broken and bleeding corpses. Men and women in full combat rig had been tossed around like rag dolls, and now lay crumpled in pools of their own blood. Michael Liberty thought briefly of Lieutenant Swallow and realized that he was now getting used to freshly dead bodies. Maybe he was growing the necessary emotional armor to survive in a universe at war. He found Kerrigan's canister rifle, rammed through the front plexus shield of a toppled Goliath walker. From up ahead came the sounds of battle. Despite himself, he cradled his own gauze rifle and pressed forward. And he was rewarded with the privilege of watching Sarah Kerrigan fight. It was blood poetry, war ballet. She had reached the center of the command center now, armed with her knife and a slug thrower. She would wink into existence, slit a throat, then wink out again. Marines would rush to that location, and she would appear a few feet away, firing a burst, point blank, into the helmet of her target. Then gone, then back again, this time with a spinning kick that broke the neck of a bellowing officer. Mike brought his weapon up, but found he could not fire. It was more than just a reluctance to take human life. He could not tell where she was at any one time. And through it all, she moved with a cat-like grace and determination that shredded every opponent she encountered. She was very good with knives. More important, she was like the Protoss, glorious and deadly. He stood in the entrance for only a minute, but it was enough time for Kerrigan to dispatch every enemy in the command center. The only survivors were the ones who chose to flee at the outset. Only then did Kerrigan come fully into view, sinking to her knees in exhaustion, her back to Liberty. Mike walked up behind her and moved to put his hand on her shoulder. His hand never reached her. Without hesitation, she spun in place, grabbed his outstretched wrist with one hand, and brought up her combat knife with the other. Only when the tip of the knife was inches from Mike's face did she freeze. Her face was a mask of rage. Fear flooded Mike's mind, and in an instant, he knew she was aware of that fear. "Don't do that," she said, biting off each word. Then she dropped her knife and put her face in both hands. "You're afraid of me." Mike hesitated for a moment, then settled on, "You betcha." "I'm sorry," she said. "Sorry you had to see this." Mike took a deep breath. "I just never visited you at work before. You rest for a moment. I've got to kick off a revolution." He shoved a broken body from the communications console, inserted the pre-recorded disc, set the levels, and put out a general signal on all bands. "This is Michael Liberty, broadcasting from Antigua Prime, with a report that the Master Command Center for this world has been disabled by rebel forces. Repeat, the Master Command Center has been disabled. The power of the Confederacy has been interrupted, and there is a strong possibility that it can be shattered entirely if the people of Antigua rise up to take control of their own destiny. The Confederate Marines in charge of the command center are either dead or in full retreat, while rebel losses have been..." He looked at Sarah Kerrigan, exhausted, weeping into her hands. "Been minimal. We have a message here from Arcturus Mensk, leader of the Sons of Korhal. Please, stand by." Mike popped the pre-programmed cartridge into the player and let the smooth, melodious tones of the terrorist leader rouse the people to action. Mike went back to Kerrigan, this time circling her so she knew he was coming. Her eyes were dry now, but she was shuddering. Her arms crossed in front of her, her breathing in short gasps. "It's okay," said Mike. "You got them all." "I know," she said, looking at Mike. "I got them all. And as I killed each and every one of them, I knew what they were thinking. Fear, panic, hatred, hopelessness, breakfast."
"Breakfast?
One of the techs had skipped breakfast, and he was really regretting not having had waffles. Kerrigan gave a sniffling giggle. He was about to have his throat slit, and he was worrying about waffles. She put her hands along the sides of her head and ran her fingers through her red hair. It sucks being a telepath.
I'll bet, said Mike, aware that the fear was still with him.
The fear that Kerrigan could cut open his belly before he could even react, and that she knew he was thinking that. I know you're afraid, said Kerrigan, and you can admit it. That makes you smarter than most. God, what I went through to become this, what the Confederates did to me. Do you know?
I know that the Confederacy has a lot of deep holes to hide their secrets in. Deeper and blacker than I ever imagined. Ghost training was for an elite group of carefully controlled telepaths.
Kerrigan was nodding as he spoke. Control through drugs and threats and brutality, until they owned you body and soul. They are no better than these Zerg creatures, creating warriors for a larger empire. We have no lives but the ones the Confederacy allows us, until we are no longer useful, and then we are discarded, lest we create future problems, unless...
Unless you escape, said Mike. Or someone helps you escape.
And he suddenly realized why this former ghost was working for Arcturus Mengsk. She owed him her life.
Kerrigan just nodded in response.
There's more to it, but yes.
There were heavy footfalls at the entrance, and Mike rose with his gauze rifle ready. Raynor's armored form appeared in the doorway.
You children okay? He shouted.
We're done here, said Mike. Center captured, message delivered.
Good, said Captain Raynor, because we got a chunk of Alpha Squad coming up from the south, and we're going to need all the help we can get handling them. She okay?
I'm fine, said Kerrigan, rising to her feet. You can talk to me directly, you know.
Maybe I'll just think it at you, said Raynor.
Jim, Mike said sharply, that's enough.
What?
Raynor looked surprised by Mike's tone.
That's enough, repeated Mike, his tone less heated, but still grave.
His serious voice. The large captain looked at Mike, then slowly nodded.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
To Kerrigan he said,
Sorry to offend, ma'am.
Used to it, Captain, said Kerrigan. You said we had more Confederates to kill. Let's get a move on.
She forced her way past both men, phasing invisible as she went.
Captain Raynor shook his head.
Women.
Mike softened his tone. She's been under a lot of stress lately. Raynor snorted.
Could have fooled me.
The pair followed Raynor out of the building. Along the horizon, there were small flashes of battle as the Antigans and Confederates met in combat. Above them, in the darkening sky, there were other flashes of another battle. They danced across the sky like new stars, and ended only when a brilliant meteor streaked across the sky, splitting the screaming atmosphere in its wake. Chapter 10 The Wreck of the NORAD II.
There's an old Earth word. It's called Schadenfreude. The feeling of elation that comes from learning of the suffering of others. Like when you hear that a rival newsman suddenly was caught cursing in front of a live mic, or that a particularly corrupt alderman just stepped in front of a garbage truck. It's elation accompanied by that twinge of guilt for feeling so good, and the quiet, fervent prayer that something that bad never happens to you. With the Protoss and Zerg biting deep into Confederate territory, we had Schadenfreude in buckets. The Liberty Manifesto. Other men and women went to war. Mike returned to Mengsk's base and monitored the flow of communications. There was the blind panic he had come to expect during warfare. Units suddenly cut off and demanding, then pleading for, reinforcements, then relief. And finally, rescue. Other messages from units that suddenly evaporated in a haze of radiation. And still other messages, these, from civilians, asking for help from anyone on any side. And then there were the anomalous reports, the ones of monsters suddenly appearing in the countryside, ascribed to the Confederates, or the rebels, or to invasions from beyond. These reports were growing more numerous by the hour, and they convinced Mike that Kerrigan was right. The Zerg were on Antigua. He wanted to hit the console when that realization sank in. Zerg presence was as good as a cancer diagnosis, and much more fatal. Until they figured out how to defeat them, the Zerg would eat this world alive. Or the Protoss, fatal chemotherapy, would sterilize it to keep the Zerg from spreading. "But it doesn't work that way, does it?" said Mike to the comm unit. "A few cells always seem to escape and the cancer keeps growing." The fury he felt in his belly lasted only a moment, then was replaced with an amazement as the next message rattled through his earpiece.
"This is General Duke, calling from the Alpha Squadron flagship NORAD 2. We've crash-landed and are being hit hard by the Zerg. Request immediate backup from anyone receiving this signal. Repeat, this is a Priority 1 distress call. This is General Duke."
The distress call went into a loop, and Michael listened to it three more times before checking the other channels. There were a couple calls asking for confirmation, and a plethora of other responses, describing attacks by the Zerg and Antiguan rebels, and in one case, an assault by other Confederate forces. And there were now reports of Protoss ships in system fighting something themselves, probably Zerg similar to the ones that brought down the NORAD 2, out in the outer rim of Ice Worlds. There were even some reports of Protoss ground forces appearing. There was a lot of noise, but nothing that resembled an honest, solid offer of help. "He's cooked," thought Michael. "Old Duke's goose is finally cooked." Raynor stormed in about 10 minutes later.
"Mike, you're with me, suit up."
"What's up?" Mike asked, reaching for his combat armor.
"You didn't hear the news in here?"
Raynor looked as though lightning bolts would spring from his brow at any moment. "The normal panic and despair?" said Mike, waving at the board. "Oh yeah, I heard Duke finally got promoted to general. Should we send a fruit basket?"
"Funny, news hound. Manx wants us to go in and rescue him. He thinks Duke would make a good ally."
Mike blinked at the captain. "I'm hearing things, right?"
"That's what I said,"
Raynor said, holding out Mike's helmet. "He's crazy."
"It's been noted,"
Raynor said grimly. "And Mengsk wants me to go? It's news I can cover from here."
"I want you to come along. That bastard locked me and my boys up. I'm going to want someone there who he's willing to talk to."
Did I mention that the last time I talked to him, he had me forcibly ejected from his bridge? Said Mike, taking the helmet.
"It's come up, but at least I'm sure you're not going to shoot him right away."
Mike locked down the helmet and followed Raynor out of the comm area. "I suddenly have a craving for a cigarette."
"Maybe you can bum one off Duke."
Only when they were on the road did Mike think to ask, "Does Kerrigan know about this?"
"Uh-huh."
"And she thinks it's a good idea."
"Actually,"
said the former lawman,
"she's the one who called Manx crazy."
"So you two agreed on something? I'm amazed."
"Yeah,"
said Raynor. Then there was a pause.
"Yeah, I guess we did."
Arcturus Mengsk was starting to rally troops now to his banner, and when Raynor and Mike arrived on the surface, the assault to rescue the downed battlecruiser was already underway. The units that barreled across the flats now included Antiguan rebels, Sons of Korhal, and Confederate stragglers that had discarded their loyalties and kept their weapons. Raynor rode at the left flank of a flight of Vulture hovercycles, while overhead, a squadron of A-17 Wraith fighters tore through the sky. Huge Goliaths left great splayed footprints in the soft mud, and they soon overtook a unit of arc-light siege tanks, churning across the bottomlands, their support frames pulled up for movement. The combined forces met resistance almost immediately. Zerglings and Hydralisks spattered on all sides of them, like bugs on a windshield. The air was filled with both the organic cannons, now known to Mike and the rest of human space as Mutalisks, and creatures that looked like jellyfish brains with lobster claws. They drifted over the alien forces like storm clouds in the desert. There was a cluster of marines off to Mike's right, swarming up the sides of what looked like a giant upright zergling, a titanic creature with front claws like huge hooked sabers. On the horizon, something that looked like a cross between a flying squid and a giant starfish fled from the assault of the Wraith fighters. They plowed through the Zerg forces, routing some, eliminating others. A group of Zerglings erupted from the ground and took out a full unit of Marines before the vultures arrived and laid down a blanket of withering fire. The Zerg fell back, returned in greater numbers, then fell back again. Mike felt he was fighting the sea. The waves were being beaten back, but he was sure that it was an illusion. The tide was coming in, and it would return in greater force. In his gut, Mike knew that Antigua Prime was damned as Chausara and Marsara had been. These things were burrowing through the heart of the world, and either they would be successful, or the Protoss would burn them from space. The Zerg line stiffened for a moment, then broke again, and the humans were through, heading for the uplands where the NORAD-2 went down. With one glance at the starship, Mike could see that the old behemoth would never fly again. Its rear engine pods had been twisted at a 45-degree angle to the rest of the structure, and the lower landing struts, if they had even been deployed, had been mired totally in the mud. The ship's forward bridge hung precariously over the edge of the mesa, with a view of the devastation beneath it. Mike and Raynor gunned their engines for an open hatchway and drove their vultures on board. They sealed the hatch behind them manually, while outside, another wave of Mutalisks popped up over the horizon.
"Which way?"
asked Raynor, pulling off his helmet.
"Come on," said Mike, tearing off toward the bridge.
He moved through the tight spaces of the NORAD-2 effortlessly, despite his combat armor. He had noticed that Mengsk provided larger hallways on his ship than the Confederacy managed. It was as if Duke had never left the bridge. The silverback gorilla was still hunched over his station in his armored hide. The only change was the number of screens around him that showed nothing but static, and a cascade of fiber-optic cables draped along one bulkhead. He turned to the newcomers and scowled.
"You're about the last folks I expected to show up," he growled.
"Yeah, we love you too, General," said Mike, pushing his way to the ship's comm unit. He punched in the communication code for Menx's base.
"What's all this about?"
Duke barked.
"A word from our sponsor," said Mike. "It feels like years since I last said that. Anyone got a cig?"
On the screen, the static-scarred form of Arcturus Mengsk formed. Mengsk, thought Mike, safe in his secret readout while the rest of us did the fighting and bleeding. Mike didn't think it possible, but Duke's scowl deepened.
"What's your angle, Mengsk?"
he asked.
"Our angle?"
Raynor snarled.
"I'll give you an angle, you slimy Confederate piece of—"
"Easy, Jim," said Mike.
"In case you haven't noticed," said Mengsk, "the Confederacy has fallen apart, Duke. Its colonies are in open revolt. The Zerg are rampaging unchecked. What would have happened here today if we hadn't shown up?"
"Your point?"
Duke kept a stone face. Mike checked the other screens. Another Wraith attack had dispersed the Mutalisks, but the flying starfish looked to be made of tougher stuff.
"I'm giving you a choice," Mengsk said smoothly. "You can go back to the Confederacy and lose, Or you can join us and help save our entire race from being overrun by the Zerg.
You expect me to answer that?
I don't think it's a difficult decision.
A small smile appeared beneath Menx's gray, spattered mustache.
I'm a general, for God's sake, Duke exploded.
Oh, yeah, said Mike. Congratulations. Shall you put it on your tombstone?
Michael, please, said Menx. Duke, you're a general without an army. I'm offering you a position on my staff, in my cabinet, not just some backwater post where they shelved you before the war.
I don't know, said Duke, and Mike saw the warrior waver for a moment. Menx had him. Poor Duke, he had been hooked. He just didn't know it yet.
Don't test my patience, Edmund, said Menx.
Somewhere beyond the bulkheads, something exploded near the ship, almost as if it had been planned to punctuate Menx's comment. Duke held the moment for a decorous beat, then said,
All right, Menx, you've got a deal. You've made the right choice. General Duke, said Menx. Captain Raynor?
Yes, sir.
Raynor was scowling now.
Escort the general's supporters and equipment to a safe location.
As Menx spoke, Duke enabled the ship's self-destruct. In 20 minutes, they would be clicks away, and the NORAD II would be a thermonuclear fireball. I hope it takes a lot of Zergs with it, said Mike, as the bridge started to clear very, very fast. Later, Mike was back at Menx's communication center. With the explosion of the NORAD II, there had been a lull in the fighting. Confederate troops, including the nearly resocialized ones, had switched sides easily, with official permission, and now the only enemies to deal with were inhuman. The downside was that there was no shortage of these. Mike wrapped up a report on the NORAD II rescue and shot it into the net. He leaned back and ran a hand through his hair. It felt thinner than before. A pack of cigarettes, slightly crushed, dropped onto the console, followed by a foil container of matches. Raynor said,
One of the crew of the NORAD says, You're even now.
Excellent, said Mike, drawing out a coffin nail.
Sending another report to nowhere?
I thought Kerrigan was the mind reader, but yeah. Old habits die hard, though I have the fantasy that someone finds these reports years later and appreciates all the sacrifice of men and women against these things, and all the stupidity as well. Raynor settled down into a chair across from him as Mike lit up.
Unlikely. Like Menx says, the victors write the histories. Losing memoirs are deleted like yesterday's data.
Mike took a deep draw and coughed, making a face.
What did they marinate these in? Cat urine?
Raynor raised his hands.
Best I could find, under the circumstances.
Story of our lives.
You betcha, said Mike. Speaking of the Ubermensk, how did your talk with Arcturus go?
I told him that Duke was a snake, Raynor sighed. And he said
that he was our snake, right? Raynor shook his head in disbelief.
I believe in Menx's cause, that the Confederacy has to go, and he did get me out of stir, but, man... Some of the deals he's making. Some of the things he's asking us to do.
Don't go following causes, said Mike, taking a painful puff. They'll just break your heart. When idealism meets reality, it's rarely reality that backs down. I've seen more good government types turn into political hacks than I've seen Zerglings. And I've seen a lot of Zerglings. There was a silence between the two men. In the background, the muted comm units spoke of mutalisks and wraiths, of goliaths and hydralisks, and the starfish things, which they were calling Zerg queens, and death. They spoke incessantly of death.
I tell you I was married once,
Raynor volunteered. The chasm of personal interaction yawned wide and deep at Mike's feet.
It hasn't come up, he said calmly, hoping that he was not expected to share back. Married. Had a kid. He was gifted, they said.
I heard the quotation marks around that. Gifted like in ghost material? Psionic powers? Telepathic?
Uh-huh. Sent him off to a special school. Government scholarship. A few months later, we got a letter. There had been an incident at the school.
Mike had heard of such letters. They were unfortunately as common as grass when dealing with telepaths. Another of the Confederacy's dirty little secrets rarely broadcast. I'm sorry, Mike said, because that was all he could say.
Yeah. Liddy never recovered. She just sort of wasted away. That winter she went down with the flu. And afterwards I threw myself into my work. Found out I liked working alone.
It's an easy trap to fall into, hiding in your work, said Mike, looking at the transmit light of his comlink, which meant his report was being sent out into the void.
Anyway, I wanted you to know, said Raynor. You may have thought I was being hard on Kerrigan for being a telepath. Maybe I was, but I have my reasons.
She's got her own problems, you know, like everybody else and like no one you've ever met. You might want to cut her a little slack.
It's kind of hard when she knows what you're really thinking.
Kerrigan seems to be a good soldier, said Mike, the image of her as a death-dealing dervish rising unbidden in his mind. She may be wound a little tight, that's all.
I think she's dangerous, said Raynor. Dangerous to the troops around her, dangerous to Minsk, and dangerous to herself.
Mike shrugged, unsure how much he could comfortably reveal to the ex-marshal. He settled at last for, she's had a tough life.
And we've had it easy so far.
All the more reason to keep an eye on her. Watch her back, whether she knows it or not, though she probably will. We all need guardian angels. The conversation shifted after that to questions of what worlds were in rebellion and what effect Duke's defection would have on other military leaders. Finally, Raynor took his leave and abandoned Mike to the soft urgency of the communications room. Mike looked at the half-empty pack of cigarettes. The taste of the first one was still pungent in his mouth. Hell, he said, reaching for the pack and the matches. I guess around here, you can learn to tolerate just about anything. Chapter 11. Chess. I played chess with Arcturus Mengsk. I lost regularly, by the way. Someday I'll probably be dragged before some high justice and told that this was a crime against the state, but I will have no defense. Other than losing more times than I won. More often than not, Mengsk would dangle some bait in front of me in a game and I would snap at it only to discover too late that I had been distracted from the trap he was setting. The entire human campaign against the Zerg was similar, consisting of a series of defeats, each one more galling than the last because each time we ignored what was really going on. Our first warning that the Zerg were planetside came usually too late, when the creep appeared at our doorstep or the Protoss warped in with the Thunder God ships. We thought we could escape it. Some of us, including Mengsk himself, thought we could control it. But we were all pawns in a greater game. No, not pawns. Dominoes. Each falling in turn, planet after planet, person after person, until we reached the biggest domino of them all, the one called Tarsonis, the Liberty Manifesto.
The comparison has been made between war and chess, said Arcturus Mengsk, forking his knight to threaten both Mike's queen and his bishop.
You're very good at both, said Mike, moving his queen to take Mengsk's rook.
Actually, I find the comparison to be false, said the terrorist, moving his knight to take the bishop. Checkmate, by the way.
Mike blinked at the board.
Menx's strategy was obvious now, in the same way that it had been totally opaque mere seconds before. The reporter mentally kicked himself and reached for his brandy snifter. In the background, the lost tunes of Ancient Miller and Goodman warbled out of the comm unit. The ashtray to one side of the board was filled with butts, all of them mics. They smelled faintly of cat urine. They were on board the Hyperion, resting in a hidden hangar on Antigua Prime. Duke was off reorganizing the rebel troops into something that was more Confederate in nature. Raynor was off trying to keep Duke from making a complete mess of things. Mike had no idea where Kerrigan was, but that was normal for Kerrigan. "Chess is not like war?" Mike asked.
"Once, perhaps it was," said Mengsk. "On old Earth, back in the mists of time. Two equal opponents with equal forces on a level playing field."
"And that's not the case. Not anymore."
"Hardly," said the terrorist, warming to his own discussion. "First, the opponents are hardly ever truly even. The Confederacy of Man had apocalypse-class missiles, and my homeworld did not. The Confederacy played that card until Core Hall 4 was a blackened glass sphere hanging in space. Hardly even. Similarly, our little rebellion seemed at first to be undermanned and underfunded, but with each new revolt, the Confederacy loses more of its will to fight. It is ancient and rotten, and all it needs is a good push to cave it in. You don't see that in chess. Second, Manx continued, is the idea of equal forces. I mention the missiles so effective in my father's time, yet mere pinpricks in the light of the forces being wielded today. Forces continue to evolve. Nukes, telepaths, now Zerg being raised by the Confederacy.
War is supposed to increase development, said Mike.
Yes, but most people use the guns and armor analogy. One side gets a better gun, the other side gets better armor, which inspires a still better gun, and so on. The truth is that a better gun inspires a chemical counterweapon, which then inspires a telepathic strike, which then brings about an artificial intelligence guiding the weapon. The pressure of war does bring about growth, but it is never the neat, linear growth that you learn about in a classroom.
Or read about in the papers. Menx smiled.
Third is the idea of a level playing field. The chessboard is limited to an 8x8 grid. There's nothing beyond this little universe. No 9th rank. No green pieces that suddenly sweep onto the board to attack both black and white. No pawn that suddenly become bishops.
A pawn can become a queen, Mike noted.
But only by advancing through all the spaces of its row, under fire the entire time. It doesn't suddenly blossom into a queen by its own volition. No. Chess is nothing like war, which is one of the reasons I play it. It's so much simpler than real life.
Not for the first or last time, Mike thought about Menx's almost supernatural ability to warp reality around himself. You think that the Confederacy is going to be able to come up with a weapon against these latest attacks? Against the Protoss and the Zerg?
Unlikely, though they are pulling out all the stops. Doing what they do best right now. Propaganda and silencing those who speak out. Those are their best weapons, and they have never hesitated to use them before. But they're just throwing spitwads at a bull elephant that's bearing down on them. Hang on. I've got something here I wanted to show you.
Mengsk pressed numerous buttons on a remote control. He stared at it, as if trying to remember a secret code. I thought you once said that the Confederacy was breeding the Zerg. Doesn't that make the Zerg their weapons? Mike asked.
Originally, I thought so as well.
Mengsk pressed a few more buttons, then paused.
And though I may be incorrect in the assumption, as far as our propaganda is concerned, that's our story and we're sticking with it. Nothing undermines faith in the government faster than realizing they've been developing deadly alien menaces in their spare time.
But the truth really is? Mike prompted.
The truth is as malleable as ever.
Menx grinned.
Yes, the Confederacy has been studying the Zerg for years, and the ones in the Sara system were deliberately brought there by Confederate agents. Yes, they were a big weapons test. But no, they didn't create the Zerg. No, they had a much worse plan in mind. It was on those disks that you and Reyna brought back from the Jacobs installation. Here we go. You'll appreciate this.
He hit a button, and the screen sprang to scratchy life. When the distortion had cleared, Mike could see a string of low buttes and mesas beneath an orange-brown sky. The scene could have been anywhere on Antigua Prime, the familiar UNN logo perched along one side, and multi-planetary stock prices crawled across the bottom of the screen. Then, a frighteningly familiar voice spoke over the panorama. "This is Michael Liberty reporting from Antigua Prime." Mike blinked. That was his voice, part of his last transmission out, but he had never sent this particular footage. Had they pulled it from a file somewhere? The camera continued to pan, then settled on the speaker. He was dressed in a neat duster, much neater than the one that currently hung in Mike's locker, his blonde hair pulled back to cover a bald spot, his features hard-chiseled and experienced, his eyes deep and soulful. It was Michael Liberty, but not Mike. This Michael Liberty looked almost like an idealized version of Mike himself. The figure on the screen continued, "This reporter has just escaped captivity at the hands of the infamous terrorist Arcturus Mengsk. I was captured on Marsara by the rebels shortly before the reptilian Protoss destroyed the planet and have only made it to safety now." "That's not me," said Mike.
No, said Mengsk. "And the Protoss aren't reptiles as far as we know, but keep watching."
"During my captivity, I learned that Mengsk and the Sons of Korhal are in control of powerful mind-control drugs, which they have been using freely on the populace," continued the flat-screen Mike Liberty. "Hundreds have died as a result of indiscriminate spraying, which can only be described as chemical attacks against innocent citizens. Others have been warped into strange mutagenic shapes as a result of side effects of these drugs." Mengsk made a rude noise. But the figure on the screen continued. "Mengsk sent a saboteur aboard the NORAD II and exposed the crew to a virulent toxin. The result was the recent crash of that ship. Agents of the Sons of Korhal captured those affected by the mind-control drugs and left the rest to die at the hands of their Zerg allies." "Zerg allies? Who's writing that crap?" Mike snapped at the screen.
"It is much of muchness," Menx said calmly, "laying it on a bit thick and all."
"I believe that General Edmund Duke, scion of the Duke family of Tarsonis, has fallen prey to these mind-control devices and now has been reduced to a mentally reprogrammed zombie in the service of the terrorists. In this way, Menx and his inhuman allies hope to confuse the brave warriors of the Confederacy and cause them to lose faith in their leaders." "Brave warriors of the... I used that line in a filler piece I did on the NORAD too," said Mike. "And the bit about virulent toxins? That rings another bell."
"Groundwater pollution outside a middle school," said Menx. "One of your better early pieces, if I remember right."
"Only by eternal vigilance can we root out such terrorists as Mengsk and his mind-controlled minions," said the figure on the screen. "As I speak, a massive Confederate blockade is surrounding Antigua Prime, and the terrorists should be destroyed within a few days. This is Michael Daniel Liberty for UNN.
Mengsk hit another button. Michael Daniel Liberty froze into silence on the screen.
"Did you see that?"
Mike shouted, jumping up from his seat.
"That wasn't me!"
"I hope not," Menk said with a calm grin. "You seem like such a rational and truthful reporter, most of the time."
"What did they do?"
"You've never been edited before?"
Mengsk raised an eyebrow.
"Of course," Mike snapped, then added quickly, "I mean, for time, or if the facts couldn't be confirmed, or the legal department had a problem, or a sponsor raised a stink. I mean, I've had things cut before, and sometimes they've slid in images that took the tone of the story in a different direction, but this is a...
lie?
Fabrication,"
Mike said, frowning.
"Indeed. Clipped together from bits of previous reporting, using another actor as a stand-in, a shuffling of pixels. Mind you, it's easy enough on a flat screen, damned impossible with a true hologram. That's why I prefer the latter, you know. This is just enough to fool someone just catching the news, to remind them that you're alive and well and fighting the good fight for UNN and the Confederacy."
"But my reports," Mike sputtered.
"Grist that they took apart and reassembled as they saw fit."
Mike slouched back into his chair.
"I'm going to kill Anderson."
"Your Anderson may already be dead, I'm afraid," said the terrorist. "If he's as devoted a reporter as you."
Mike snorted.
"Or,"
Menx reconsidered,
"he may be acquiescing to the current power structure, though he knows it's a horrible idea. Maybe that's why the toxic poisons line is in there, a bit of internal sabotage, a desperate cry for help. I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why would mind-controlled drugs be poisons? Of course, it did let them lift an entire sentence verbatim."
"Yeah, that's a shortcut Handy Anderson would take."
"I just wanted you to know that your own network has turned its back on you. I didn't want you to find out at a bad time. Like on the battlefield, for example."
Mengsk refilled Mike's snifter.
"But why this?"
"Propaganda's a weapon that the Confederacy wields best and wields heaviest. It is their hammer, and when all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail."
"You'd think they'd have better weapons than a reporter to throw at you," Mike muttered. He shook his head at the screen. "What happened to all their Zerg research? The material we got out of that installation?"
"Ah."
Mengsk hit another series of buttons.
"The Jacob's disk. I'm glad you remembered that. It shows that my mind-controlled drugs have not had a complete effect on you. Don't look at me that way, it was meant as a joke."
"I'm a little sensitive about that right now. It'll pass."
"I expected weapons data, something to keep them ahead of the technological curve. Instead, I found something much more interesting. Here we go. You know about ghosts, of course."
Mike thought of Kerrigan, the merciless fighter who felt the death of each of her victims. Telepathic warriors. A specialty of the Confederates, and an example of your technological curve.
"An interesting example, if I may digress. The original inhabitants of the colony ships were Earth people, but a long voyage apparently put a twist in their genetic code, enough to bring out more psionic abilities than were common in the original Terran populace. An interesting happenstance."
"I think we've both gotten to the point where we don't believe in happenstance." Mike took a pull on his brandy. Mengsk gave a good-natured shrug.
"By design or accident, the humans of what would become the Confederacy tended toward psychic abilities. Again, through design or accident, we found this out and created the ghosts. Superior assassins with mind-reading powers. It's a horrible process. Only a few children make it out of the process in any usable state. And, until recently, The Confederates' control over them seemed unbreakable.
Lieutenant Sarah Kerrigan, how did you break their control over her?
That's a case where one side gets better armor, and the other side gets a bigger gun,
Menk said with a smile.
Suffice it to say that the control over her was broken, and broken in such a way that she was left amazingly intact and generally useful.
And grateful.
And grateful, Menk admitted. And she has appeared often enough that the Confederates are in a tizzy about it.
Which suits you just fine, said Mike. But you were busy digressing.
Yes. Now we get to the Jacobs disc. It turns out that our pestilent friends, the Zerg, are attuned to psychic emanations. Apparently, the wavelengths that the ghosts function on are similar to those that the higher-level Zerg use to control the lesser ones, so they can zero in on them at close range.
How close? Mike asked, thinking suddenly of Kerrigan's activities in the Sara and Antigua systems.
For a normal telepath, very, very close. Tens of yards at best. By that time a Hydralisk can smell them anyway. But that's part of the technology the Confederates have used in their tower defenses and other anti-ghost detectors.
Guns and armor? Can the ghosts read Zerg minds like they do humans?
It's much more painful. And yes, the Confederates tried. They came away with the idea that the Zerg are an ultimate evolutionary success stories. Everything is either genetic material for their creations, or meat to be fed to their children. They operate off a hierarchy of hive minds, each greater than the ones below it, growing up to near-planetary consciousness.
Sounds appealing. Mike took another long sip of his brandy. It burned the back of his throat and reminded him he was human.
Nasty. The Protoss are as bad, said Manksk. Mind you, this is all from the Zerg viewpoint that's recorded on the disks. But the Protoss are the ultimate genetic purists. They see themselves as the judges of the universe, eradicating any life that gets out of hand. It does not meet their standard of perfection.
Genetic survivors versus genetic xenophobes. A match made in hell.
Very much so. So, the Confederates discover the Zerg and discover the telepathic attraction. They want more Zerg available.
More? Why in the name of God would they want more?
The non-linear nature of war, son. They were looking for a weapon with all the advantages of nukes and none of the downside, like radiation or bad press. The Zergs were perfect. They were ugly, buggy aliens that the Confederates could unleash on anyone and then come in afterwards and eliminate. A pocket plague of monsters.
You said you thought they were breeding them.
And I was wrong about that, Manx said smoothly. Breeding them is much more complex than just capturing a bunch of Zerglings and putting them in the same cage. So they needed to lure more into their traps, and that's where the telepaths came in.
But the telepaths have limited range.
Yes, Manx agreed. So they worked on improving that range. What you pulled out of the Jacobs installation was the plans for a transplanar psionic waveform emitter. Nice name, and fairly self-descriptive. With it, they could boost the power of a telepath and make it an interplanetary beacon for the Zerg, drawing them in like moths to a lantern.
Mike was silent for a moment, then said, "The Sara system."
Exactly. That's what I mean when I say they were using those planets as a testing ground for their weapons. They brought the Zerg to Sara, and the Protoss came after them. But they brought more than just a couple Zerglings. They brought the whole Zerg ecosystem and power structure into play, which they didn't expect.
And now the Zerg are moving from system to system at will, directed by their own intelligence, intent on either transforming humanity or consuming it.
So you know how to defeat them? Mike asked.
Other than blasting each and every one of them into bits and burning their nests? No.
Mengsk leaned forward.
But I do know how to send them in the direction I want them to go.
How does that help? Mike shook his head. Had the brandy made him suddenly stupid? Mengsk leaned back.
There was one piece of truth in that news report your doppelganger delivered. There is a serious blockade forming around Antigua. The Confederates are hoping to keep us penned up until either the Zerg or the Protoss destroy us.
And we're just sitting here?
No. I'm already doing something. We built an emitter, based on the plans you liberated. We're going to take it into the heart of Confederate territory and set it off. Every Zerg from as far away as 10 light-years is going to come here. They're going to fall among the blockaders like falcons on doves. The crash of the NORAD II will be a simple fender bender in comparison.
But the emitter will only amplify. You need a telepath to... The final circuit closed in Mike's brain. Kerrigan. You're going to use Kerrigan to bring in the Zerg.
Very good.
You can't do that, Mike objected. You want her to break into a Confederate camp? They'll have detectors, she'll never make it.
I have a high degree of confidence in the lieutenant.
You can't do that, Mike repeated.
You have your tense wrong. I gave the orders for the operation before we sat down for our first game. The good lieutenant should be picking up the emitter in the shops below right about now. If you hurry, you can catch up with her.
Mike cursed and launched himself from his seat.
And wish her luck from me.
Menk shouted at Mike's back as the reporter bolted out of the terrorist leader's quarters. Then Menk leaned back, lifted his own brandy snifter, and offered a silent toast to the frozen figure of the false Michael Liberty on the screen. Chapter 12. Belly of the Beast. Aliens were pressing in on human space, and the humans reacted by turning on one another. I can only imagine what the Zerg and the Protoss thought as they landed on planets that consisted of nothing but rebels and Confederates, wailing the tar out of each other. They probably thought it was the normal behavior pattern for our race. And I suppose they would be right. Menx's successes, spread in part by bootleg copies of my own reports, sparked dozens of brushfire wars. Every crank with a gripe took up arms against the ancient Confederate regime. The Confederacy, in turn, reacted as it always had to armed dissent, with harsher and harsher oppression that in turn spawned other revolts. And through it all, the Zerg were infiltrating more planets, and the Protoss were turning them to dead lumps. The humans didn't have so many worlds that they could afford to lose them at this clip. If the two sides had been thinking, they would have joined forces to fight the true menace. I think everybody was so busy planning and fighting that no one really had time to think. The Liberty Manifesto.
Kerrigan!
Mike shouted in the landing bay. The lieutenant was just putting on her helmet. He had no time for armor, but he did grab his duster. Liberty, she said grimly. Mike saw a large device mounted to the side of her vulture bike. I'm just heading out.
Ride shotgun?
Look, normally I'd... She began, then looked at Mike with her deep jade-green eyes. The hairs on the back of Mike's neck stood up, and he knew that she knew. Her two wide lips twitched for a moment. Then she shook her head and said, It's your funeral. I'll need someone to lug the gear anyway. Come on. The pair roared out of the hangar, making for the rendezvous point. Antigua Prime had suffered under the relentless assault. The sky was darker now from the smoke of continuous pyres. and the great bloated figure of the world's gas giant primary hung like a sorrowful god behind a shroud of mourning. In the distance, there was the thunder of arc light artillery, though who was firing, and who they were firing at, was unknown. They passed abandoned bunkers, cracked open like eggshells, surrounded by the partially buried detritus of war, broken weapons, and shattered men. The thunder grew louder, and Liberty realized they were heading into the heart of the storm. "We've got siege tanks and Goliaths," Kerrigan said over the comlink, "trying to punch a hole in their lines. We slipped through and into Confederate territory. Regret coming now? Maybe a little." Mike knew that the ghost knew his answer even before he spoke. "So, Manx gave you the whole song and dance?" she continued. Mike frowned, concerned that the telepath was rummaging through his thoughts so easily. "Got you to come along?"
"Check my mental replay again, Lieutenant," said Mike. "Manx never asked me to go."
"He didn't have to. He knows the buttons to press on people. Probably he felt that if he ordered you to come help, you'd probably just dump him then and there."
"He's probably right."
"He usually is. That's why it's probably a good idea you're along."
Up ahead, a pile of boulders vaporized in a massive explosion. Kerrigan brought the cycle up short.
"That shouldn't happen," she said. "Our siege tanks know we're coming this way. Did Duke screw up his artillery spotting on purpose, or—"
Mike heard the whistling of another set of incoming rounds.
"It's their tanks!" he shouted.
"They've broken through our lines!"
Kerrigan gunned the engine the moment he said it, tearing the Vulture at a sharp angle to its original course of travel. The road ahead vanished in a crescendo of flying earth and rock as another round tracked closer. The shattered earth was too much for the limited grav units, and the entire bike shook.
"It's a bit—" Mike began.
"Sorry for the rough ride," Kerrigan snapped over the comlink.
"Just hang on."
"Next time, let me finish my sentence," thought Mike, and felt Kerrigan shrug on the bike. The Confederates must have had a spotter. The missile fire tracked them mercilessly, staying about 100 yards behind them. Kerrigan took them into a ravine that had long since lost anything that looked like water.
"Let's see them follow in here," she said.
Mike heard the high-pitched whine of metal slicing through air.
"Wraiths!" he yelled into the comlink.
The fighter spacecraft came in low and hard, blasting both sides of the ravine with their 25-millimeter burst lasers. The scrub was incinerated at a touch, and the fighters pulled up, unable to see their prey through the smoke they had generated.
"They're hurting us," Kerrigan's voice crackled over the comlink. "But to where?"
The ground beneath the hover cycle suddenly changed in texture, from red clays and brownish slates to a mottled clumping of gray-black moss.
"Creep," said Mike as soon as he had recognized it. "They're herding us into Zerg territory."
Kerrigan cursed and threw on the brakes, but the creep beneath the grav fields provided no traction for the bike's transducer coils. The thin bike started to fishtail, then skewed horribly to one side, plowing up a thick crust of the creep like foam on a wave. Mike shouted, and Kerrigan yelled something. The reporter clutched the container of the psi emitter, half hoping that it would provide some protection. He was sure that if anyone could get them through this, it would be the ghost lieutenant. Then the ground opened up beneath them, and they both tumbled into the darkness. Sometime later, Mike heard Kerrigan's voice, as if from a distance.
"Liberty?"
"Ugh,"
was the best Mike could reply.
"Hell, she can read my mind. Let her read this." "Is the psi emitter all right?" she asked.
"Oh, yeah. I cushioned its fall with my body."
He opened his eyes and discovered he was lying in soft, recently churned earth. That must have been what broke their fall as they pitched down the rabbit hole. He looked up. There was a jagged hole in the ceiling, probably where they tore through the creep matting. Already, the thick webbing was re-knitting across the opening.
Mike spat out some blood. He had bitten the inside of his mouth in the fall. The rest of his body seemed battered, but generally unharmed. His duster was caked with soft earth. He would feel the bruises tomorrow. If I'm lucky, he thought.
If we're both lucky, said Kerrigan.
She was already on her feet, sweeping the area with a wrist-mounted light. She had slung her canister rifle over her shoulder. Mike stood up and found himself wobbling, but unhurt. You all right? He managed.
Not bad, said the ghost. I landed on my pride, which is, I'm afraid, a lost cause. Had to shoot it, put it out of its misery. We're patsies. Fools. Mooks. Rubes.
No one expected the Confederates, Mike began, to use the terrain and situation to their advantage?
Exactly.
Which is why we're patsies. They came out to meet our attack, and then flushed us into the one place we don't want to be.
You know, this would be easier if you...
Let you finish your sentences?
Sorry. Nervous habit right now. You're practically broadcasting your fear, and that's irritating me.
Like anybody wouldn't be afraid in this situation, Mike thought, walking over to the remains of the vulture bike.
The bike is shot, Kerrigan said without looking.
And of course, she was right. The frame was bent in three places, so that the long, lean vehicle had been turned into a twisted corkscrew. Something important had been punctured, and was leaking into the ground. The bike, in spite of all its metal and shaped ceramic, had taken the fall worse than he had.
This way, said Kerrigan, pointing sharply one way along the corridor.
Any clue why?
No, but something large and foul-thinking is in the other direction. You get to carry the emitter.
Mike hoisted the emitter in its container and followed. He thought about the lieutenant's mood. After a few minutes, Kerrigan said,
It's a feedback loop.
Stop doing that!
But it is. Your fear is sent to me, and I'm in turn taking it out on you, which increases your anger.
She paused for a moment.
Something's real strange here. Wrong. I can handle this kind of thing normally. Most of the time.
Mike thought of the Zerg's supposed connection with telepaths, then wished he hadn't. Kerrigan's two wide lips twisted in a grim smile.
Yeah, I know. Rayner already gave me grief about it at the briefing with Arcturus. Thank you very much. It does explain the Confederacy's interest in telepaths, and also, there have been a lot of MIAs among the Confederate telepaths, even outside the ghost units. I hear things.
Think the Zerg are collecting their own telepath subjects? Mike asked, then realized that Kerrigan had let him finish his sentence.
Uh-huh. Hang on. Something's up ahead.
She pulled out her sidearm and edged forward, her other hand, the one with the wrist light, pointing ahead. The something was hanging across the passageway like a great spider. Her light flashed against it, and it shrank away from the beam. It was a great eye, human in appearance, its pupil contracting under the harshness of the wrist light's beam. Mike felt a wave of revulsion and nausea sweep over him. Apparently Kerrigan felt it as well, and her emotions were compounded through Mike's mind. She let out a loud curse and fired a short burst into the twitching orb. The eye thing let out a screech that sounded like glass and blew apart, the muscular strands of its web peeling back toward the wall like broken rubber bands.
What was... Mike began.
Observer? Sentry? Kerrigan guessed, and for the first time, Mike caught a bit of fear in the unshakable Sarah Kerrigan's voice. Feedback loop, he reminded himself. He willed himself to calm down. Otherwise, they would get themselves killed.
What does it feel like?
He asked as they edged past the shredded meat of the eye thing. Mike noticed that there was creep along the floors and walls of the passage.
What?
Said Kerrigan, distracted by the eye core.
You said it felt strange down here.
Strange?
Kerrigan was silent for a moment, and Mike felt she was trying to regain her emotional strength.
It's tough to describe to a hard shell. Sorry, a non-telepath. It's like you're in a hotel hallway, and there's a party in one of the rooms. As you pass it, you hear that there's a party, but it's not yours. You don't make out anything distinct, but there's a babble of voices. That's what it feels like.
Maybe psionic power on a different channel? Mike suggested.
Maybe. But it's larger, like